You're an ice cream cone. You're a lollipop. You're a baby chick. You're a pogo stick. You're a magic trick. You're a spinning top. You're special.
Neighborhood Archive listeners, I'm back again with another guest that I'm very excited to have with me. We've had some great guests over the past several podcasts we've done, and this time around it's no different. I couldn't be more excited to have this guest with us. Our guest here on episode 14 comes with a very impressive resume. Among many other eye-widening accomplishments, our guest has contributed to research and development of new medical technologies. He served as a corporate performance consultant for clients such as Johnson & Johnson, Hyundai, Coca-Cola. He's been a high school teacher, a college chaplain, a parish minister. But casual viewers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood will recognize our guest for something simpler, which is his voice.
The people who gave the money to make Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood are the people of this and other public television stations and the Sears Roebuck Foundation.
Which I'm sure that's something that anyone who's familiar with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood has heard time and time again. And with that in mind, I'm very pleased to have with me today the former president of Small World Enterprises and one-time executive vice president of Family Communications Incorporated, Mr. Elliot Daly. Mr. Daly, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
I'm delighted to do so, Tim, and I'm very delighted at what you are doing with these podcasts and with the archives. It's a really noble enterprise, and a lot of us are very grateful for what you're up to.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you find that it's useful more so than just me messing around with a hobby of mine. You know, Mr. Daly, this is something that...
Excuse me, I just have to interrupt you. Every time I hear Mr. Daly, I think somebody must be referring to my father.
Okay. Elliot is okay.
How about Elliot?
Okay. Then Elliot, let me just say that as I started thinking of topics to talk with you about, I really felt like this could turn into a multi-volume podcast here, just because your involvement, I'm sure, had been so deep behind the scenes with everything happening there in the early days of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood with Small World and so on, that I think we could talk for hours and hours. But of course, I don't want to do that, so I wanted to narrow it down to just a handful of topics today. But if you would, let's start with just the beginning. You know, obviously, if anyone is interested, I'd encourage you to check out ElliotDaly.com. It's one L and one T in Elliot, and you can take a look at his just very impressive resume and his experiences throughout the years. But for the sake of this podcast, I'd like to focus in on that early experience there with Small World and with Family Communications. If you would, kind of describe what led to your involvement? What led to your experience there with Small World and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and Family Communications?
Sure. Let's see how I can telescope this. Television didn't come into my life until I was about 13 or 14. I'm 75. I was born in 1936. And so TV just really came into homes in the 1950s when I was an early teenager. And I somehow rather intuitively understood that this phenomenon was going to change the world. And I remember in high school and then later in college writing essays about it, trying to understand how it was affecting our understanding of the world and each other and ourselves. And then later in graduate school, I studied a lot of psychology, and I went to theological seminary and majored in psychology there and studied a lot of child psych. And as my own children came along, I got particularly interested in how television shaped their view of the world. And although we restricted our children's access to television pretty severely, I got fascinated by the subject and decided it was something that I wanted to become somewhat expert at. But as it turns out, astonishingly enough, and I'm talking about now the mid-60s, the entire corpus of research and learned studies about children and television was a pile of paper about 3 inches high, and I mean that quite literally, because I amassed all of it one summer, intending to begin my understanding of the available research. So I thought, this is really strange. Why have we paid so little attention to this when it's such a massive phenomenon? But I'm not much of a research scholar, but I began writing for popular magazines, TV Guide and Look Magazine and Family Circle and people like that, about children and television. And it was in the course of doing that, both while I was a chaplain and teaching the Department of Religion for a couple of years at Middlebury College, and then for 3 years while I was a parish minister here in Princeton, New Jersey, I was doing that as a sort of a hobby. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time that a friend of mine came back from a visit to Pittsburgh and said, hey, when we were out there with our kids, they just went crazy for this program that was a local program in Pittsburgh, called Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So I got my hands on a videotape. Back in those days we called them kinescopes. And I was absolutely blown away. I mean, you know, just the sophistication, the subtlety, the depth, the complexity, the profundity. And I just thought that it was, and still think, it was the most extraordinary use to which the medium of television has ever been put. Mm-hmm. So I tracked him down, called him up, and said that I'd like to come out and meet him and see what makes him tick and maybe do an article about him. So as it turns out, that's what I did. I bundled my wife Patty and our kids into the car, and we went out and spent the weekend with Fred and Joanne and James and John. And he and I just kind of fell together and just kind of, you know, were suddenly thick as thieves and wound up in the aftermath of that. You know, spending an hour on the phone, you know, probably once a week over the course of the next 4, 5, 6 months. During that time, as it turned out, I had concluded that being a parish minister was not what I was born to do. And so I was in the process of extricating myself from that role and intending to shift more to becoming a writer. And about 6 months after I had met Fred and had written an article about him for a Presbyterian magazine called Presbyterian Life, Fred called up and said that there was a big grant in the offing from Sears, and it looked like it might enable a great expansion of the program, and would I be willing to hook up with him to work with him to do it. He said he would need some help on both the creative side and on the management side. And so it was just, you know, it was the most serendipitous or providential, depending on your theology, moment in my life, and I said, sure. So that's how we got, that's how we first got connected.
So where does Small World come into play in all of this? Was Small World already in existence?
Yeah, Small World was a for-profit corporation owned entirely by Fred Rogers. Had a couple of outside directors, Leland Hazard and I forget who the other outside director was. And through which Fred owned the property called Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And that was its primary asset. And at that time, he did not have his own production company. He was basically, you know, renting staff from QED in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And was producing, as I recall, 17 programs a year or whatever. And what the Sears grant enabled him to do was to ramp up to 65 programs a year, which was why when he invited me to join him, he said he was going to need some help on the creative side, and I wrote, you know, a number of the scripts in the first couple of years before I got sort of overwhelmed by my managerial responsibilities. But so that was what Small World was. And when I joined him, practically the first thing that I did was to realize that we needed to have a sister company that was a not-for-profit company so that we could attract and qualify for grants from corporations, foundations, the government, etc., on a not-for-profit basis. So I formed, we formed, Small World Enterprises, and then through Small World, I meant Family Communications. Mm-hmm. I think I misspoke. So we formed Family Communications, right. Inc., and we, Small World, I had been given some ownership share in that company. We gave a royalty-free license to produce Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and to the intellectual property of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood to Family Communications, Inc., to become the production vehicle, and got the funding to then hire some people as opposed to just renting QED staff. And so we built up our own independent production company, still housed, however, of course, at the QED offices. Sure. and still, to the extent necessary, also renting both facilities and people from QED to augment what we didn't have within the company.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with Fred. It sounds to me like, you know, that the two of you were somewhat cut from the same mold, from everything from your backgrounds to your interests to your passions. What was your relationship with him like?
Oh, boy. What you say about the convergence between us is true in many respects and not true in other respects. I mean, we came from very different backgrounds. Fred, of course, came from a background of great wealth and privilege and protective seclusion as a child of a wealthy family in during the Lindbergh baby kidnapping era, etc.
Right.
And I came from much more modest circumstances. But we came together powerfully around our common interest in and concern for children, our common passion for the spiritual dimension of our lives. And it's hard to describe how close we were in any way other than to say, I had the challenge of putting words in Fred's mouth. Mm. And because Fred was the most authentic human being that ever strode the earth, that meant I had to get all the way inside his mind, his psyche, his soul, his, that sounds a little presumptuous, but honest to God, that's what the challenge was.
Mm-hmm.
Because Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was a relationship between Fred Rogers and a viewing child. And so my challenge and my goal was to understand him with sufficient profundity and complexity and subtlety that I could prescribe both actions and words for him that were genuine. So that meant we spent a lot of time together and both just talking about life in general, but also collaborating around and fine tuning, you know, what was going to go into a script. But then I also had, and this is really important, the extraordinary asset at my side of Margaret McFarland,
mm-hmm.
who is the all too unsung heroine of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who may hear this podcast who are not familiar with Margaret, she was the director of the Arsenal Child and Family Study Center in Pittsburgh, founded with a couple of people who went on to achieve greater fame, Eric Erickson and Spock. And she stayed home and was extraordinarily insightful. Authority and the life of the preschool child, the inner life of the preschool child. And she was a consultant to both Fred and me on the script writing that we did. And so she not only was my tutor in deepening my own understanding of early childhood development, but also because she had been working with Fred for several years, helped me understand him and how to attune the scripts that I was writing more keenly and authentically to who Fred was.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's kind of interesting for me to hear that you had a hand in writing some of the scripts, because a lot of what you read and a lot of what you hear is that the scripts were so structured, they were so planned out, almost to the word ahead of time, that it's interesting to know that other people, you know, I hate to use the word, were allowed to contribute or were allowed to write those scripts, but at the same time, it seems like they were, I've always heard that they were so structured and so planned that it's interesting to find that other people were involved in the script writing process.
No, they were exquisitely crafted so that nothing that ever appeared on that screen wasn't thought through for its both intent and probable effect. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons that script writing by others, I know that I was the first person who, other than Fred, who ever wrote a script, but subsequent to that, a few other people did. Betsy Natus did, and some others did. But there is no writer's credit on the tail of the program credits for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The first couple of times that I wrote scripts, I mean, the first couple of times that we produced scripts that I had written, the first, you know, and all the scripts, as you probably know, were written in blocks of 1 week, mm-hmm. where we would take a theme and then explore it over the course of those 5 days. Sam Silverman, who was our producer, pasted, a writer's credit on the end of the program. And Fred was very uncomfortable with that. And it was one of those, one of those moments where he had a kind of a challenge, because he feared, he feared that if people thought that people, that others were writing what he was saying, that it would turn him into, in effect, the 6 o'clock news reader. Mm-hmm. And he just wasn't comfortable with that. And, as far as I was concerned, it didn't bother me not to have a credit the rules by at the speed of light anyhow. Right. I knew what I was doing and everybody else knew what I was doing. So it didn't matter to me whether I got a formal writer's credit or not. I think, but I'm not sure about this, that later, I mean, you know, maybe a decade later, I think it's possible that Betsy and Hedda Sheriff, and they've written a couple of scripts or something, that they may have actually appeared as writer credits. I know I discovered at one point, to my surprise, when I was Googling myself to try to find something else that I had written that I had lost track of, to find myself somewhere Googled as a writer of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So.
Hmm. Now, for the time, you know, for the time period you're talking about, we're talking 73, around there, or earlier, later?
Yes, yeah, no, that would be sort of the heart of it, right.
Okay. You know, it's fascinating to hear that about the writing credit, about how he wanted to leave that off, because, you know, again, like I said earlier, you know, like you've confirmed, that everything was so specifically fine-tuned with this program that to even consider leaving something out of the end credits that, like you said, flies by at the speed of light, you know, to leave something out with the purpose of not wanting anyone to think that those words were not his own. You know, to me, that's just fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and to Fred's credit and Fred's mind, you know, when I would give him a script, he would either adopt my words and thereby make them his own, or change them and make them his own. I mean, so that in his mind and in reality, they really were his own words, you know. And Fred, of course, never adopted anything that, from anybody at any time that wasn't his. I mean, that he didn't want to make his own. So. Mm-hmm.
What kind of stories or anecdotes, for lack of a better term, stand out in your mind from, and I know this is such a wide open question, but what are some things that stand out from your time working with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Some, you know, whether that's on the set of the show, you know, behind the scenes, whether that's, you know, from an administrative standpoint?
Okay, I'm going to give you one of my favorite stories. when Patty and I lived in Middlebury, we used to amuse ourselves with country farmhouse auctions around there. And one broiling hot day in August, I happened to be driving by an auction, and I stopped for a few minutes. And I turned out to be the only bidder on a kind of an antique raccoon coat, you know, the kind that the flappers wore back in the 20s, you know.
Sure.
And because it was about 100 degrees, I think I paid $1 for it, and nobody else could imagine finding an old raccoon coat in the heat of summer. But I thought it'd be wonderful for Patty to wear it. Football games, which are very cold in Middlebury, Vermont, in the dead of winter. So, fast forward, we moved to Pittsburgh for 1 year, and this gets back to the small world and FCI stuff, which we can come back to if you want to. But I was living in Princeton, of course, at the time, and had largely lived in Princeton forever. Patty and I were out to dinner with Fred and Joanne one night in Pittsburgh, and it was very, very snowy. And my wife is at the top of the heap of animal lovers of the world, and she was always very uncomfortable wearing this coat. She is not of the notion of killing an animal to get their fur to wrap a human being in it. It's just something that is a repugnant to her. Mm-hmm. So she was always very self-conscious and apologetic. So we're walking down a very snowy street one night in Pittsburgh with Fred and Joanne, and Patty goes into her well-rehearsed apology for this coat, you know, and, you know, emphasizing that it's an old antique from the 1920s, and Elliot got it in auction, and she never would have bought it, blah, blah, blah. And Fred, this is vintage Fred. Fred says, "Well, Patty, what's the lifespan of a raccoon?" And Patty said, "Well, gee, I don't know. I mean, it's probably, I don't know, what, 15 or 20 years or whatever." So I see 1920, 1930. You know what? He said, "All of those raccoons would have been dead by now anyhow. So I think you should just go ahead and enjoy that coat."
See, those are the kinds of stories I love hearing, because it makes it clear that what you saw on TV was what you saw in real life.
Oh, my God. He was the ultimate WYSIWYG. You know, what you see is what you get.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing, and this is really important, the only thing that the casual viewer did not get, could not get, from watching Fred on the tube is any sense of how powerful he was.
Mm-hmm.
Most powerful man I've ever known in my life.
How so?
And I've spent much of my subsequent business career dealing with people that the world considers powerful in the world of business or politics or finance or whatever. But Fred was powerful in the sense that he knew exactly who he was. He had no inkling of the fact that somebody else's opinion of him might matter in the least.
Mm-hmm.
That all all the rest of us normal human beings, on any given day, somewhere between 1% and 99% of our mind is whirring in the background wondering, how am I coming off? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Wondering about our audience. I want you, Tim, and anybody that listens to this podcast to think I'm a nice guy, I'm a smart guy, I was important at Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, blah, 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 whatever, you know? I mean, there's always this little sense of, how am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
And on a bad day, it's a big chunk of your brain, and on a good day, it scarcely matters at all. For Fred, it was never a blip on his radar chart. It just never would have occurred to him to... He was the least self-conscious man on the face of the earth. Well, there is tremendous power in that.
Sure.
He never kissed anybody's butt. He never, you know, he never took the edge off the truth. He never did anything that normal people do to try to get along, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so he was just quietly, uncompromisingly dedicated to the path that he knew he had been set on, and he was following that path. And it was amazing to see. And you would, you know, when Fred walked into a room, he was the center of attention. And it wasn't because he was a celebrity. I walked into rooms full of celebrities, and when Fred walked into the room, a hush fell over the room. You know, it's kind of like, oh, you know, people would start edgy, you know, maybe Fred's going to say something that I want to hear.
Hmm.
Truly extraordinary. And so that's what I mean by power. It was the power of self-possession.
Mm-hmm.
And the saddest irony for me was I used to do most of the public speaking for Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood because that was never anything Fred was fond of. And so I'd go around and speak to various professional groups or parent groups or whatever. And on many occasions, young mothers would tell me that their husbands, would all but forbid them, or sometimes would forbid them to let their sons watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood because he was too much of a wimp. He wasn't a proper male role model.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, oh, God, if you had any idea the strength of this man, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was a pathetically wrong-headed perception of him. On the other hand, because he was an androgynous guy, you know, and looked a little light on his feet to some people, you know, I would frequently get a question from the audience, does Fred have a family? Which was sort of the most politic way they could think of trying to find out whether he was gay or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would, you know, talk about Joanne and James and John and stuff. But he was just his own guy.
Yeah, you know, out of this whole conversation, if there is just a couple of minutes that are going to stand out, I can tell you right now it's going to be those last few minutes of just your description of him as powerful is very eye-opening, you know, because it's, as an adult doing what I'm doing with this website and with the archive, it just, I hear that a lot from other adults, you know, that oh, Mr. Rogers, he was this wimp, he was this, he was that. But the word powerful is not something that you often associate with Mr. Rogers. And your description hit the nail on the head. I think that's, it's very eye-opening, you know, and I think that a lot of people, it's too bad that a lot of people don't realize that side of Mr. Rogers and Fred Rogers as a person. Well, if I can shift gears, I know there's no easy transition from such a deep topic to back to it's kind of some nuts and bolts. But I'm curious about the merchandising aspect of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I know that Small World was, you know, when I hear of Small World Enterprises, the first thing that pops in my head are the tags on the toys and the the small print at the bottom of a book and a record and things like that. I'm curious about a couple of things there. First of all, you know, I've often heard that Fred was not necessarily against merchandising, but it makes me I've often wondered, were there any limitations there? You know, did he have his hand on that aspect of things to the point where merchandising could have taken off into this, you know, as you would expect, like, you know, for example, like with Sesame Street, where there was Sesame Street products everywhere. Could Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood have taken off to that extent? And if so, was it somewhat limited by Fred?
That's a great question. Terrific question. In order to key up the framework for that, when Fred asked me to join him, I joined him in early 1970 and moved myself and our family out to Pittsburgh for a year, Family Communications Inc. organized and up and running. And after a year there, I realized that Princeton had become our home in the years that we had lived here, and it's where I wanted to raise my family and wanted to live out our lives and so forth. And so I told Fred that I wanted to move back to Princeton and would be perfectly happy to commute to my work in Pittsburgh at my own expense every week, but that Princeton was our family home. And he was, as you might imagine, exceedingly supportive of that. And so we moved back to Princeton, and I brought Small World Enterprises with me. I was the president of Small World Enterprises, and then when I formed Family Communications Inc., I made myself EVP of that, so I would have a formal role in the company where I could go out as the bag man to get more grants from J&J and other people. So I brought Small World Enterprises as an entity back to Princeton with me, and that became the headquarters, and I began building up a staff for what we, Fred and I, referred to as non-broadcast materials. And he always wanted there to be some ways to extend a child's experience with Mr. Rogers beyond the confines of 28 minutes and 38 seconds of each daily program. And at the time I joined up with Fred, they already had, I think, one or two books that Random House had done, and there were two or three record albums of Mr. Rogers' music that CBS was printing, pressing, and distributing. And so using that as a platform, I then began developing additional lines. I hired three or four people here in the offices in Princeton, and we began developing more books, more playthings, more this and that and the other thing. There is no dimension of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that is more conflicted for me. But let me first answer your question about Fred's feelings or conflicts or editorial hand or whatever. I would say, generally speaking, that he gave me absolute carte blanche to do whatever I thought was proper and appropriate. I can't remember ever proposing anything that he vetoed. I'm trying to think. It's conceivable, you know, and that I've just, you know, blotted it out or whatever.
Sure.
But my general sense is that he said, you know, take this and run with it, Elliot, and trusted that I wasn't going to do anything, ridiculous or anything that was going to bring harm or shame or whatever on the larger enterprise. Mm-hmm. So it was probably the worst expression of judgment that Fred ever rendered, because I was perfectly capable of I had great aspirations for the non-broadcast materials, and I probably would have pushed the envelope into areas that I don't know that I would have, but I'd have been more tempted than he, and I'll be absolutely frank why. I was financially ambitious. You know, I didn't have any money. I'd been a teacher. I'd been a minister. I didn't come from any dough, and I wanted to make some money. And mm-hmm. and as a co-owner of Small World Enterprises, I thought I had an opportunity to make some serious money. You know, we have a nationally famous program and blah, 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 blah. So I was more motivated than Fred by financial success for Small World Enterprises. He was not at all motivated by financial success. His entire motivation in the thriving of Small World was to, as I said before, extend the experience with Mr. Rogers or Mr. Rogers' proxies beyond the compass of the program itself. And that was mine, but mine was also contaminated with some greed, okay? Mm-hmm. But I also, it was the first time that I had been responsible for a business enterprise, and I made one really grievous error, which I was careful not to repeat in any of my subsequent and considerably more successful business enterprises, and that is that I eschewed any market research. Mm. I mean, I was so smart. I was such a creative guy. I so well understood Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and I thought I so well understood, you know, preschool children and their parents, that I just, you know, I was a cornucopia of brilliant ideas, and most of them turned out not to be so brilliant. And if I had done even a soupçon of market research, I probably would have learned. Well, I not probably. I would have learned a lot. I'm not quite sure to this day what I would have learned. I might conceivably have learned that no, people actually really didn't want to buy Mr. Rogers related products. Or I might have learned that there was a whole theme of Mr. Rogers related products that would have leapt off the shelves, you know, with the speed of light. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is, Small World Enterprises was never very successful. The line of merchandising was never very successful. But it never had anything to do with Fred's putting a foot on the brake. It had more to do with Elliot's blunders and obtuseness and greed and self-satisfaction and general operating stupidity in terms of how to build a successful product line.
So with that in mind, I guess my other side of this question would be almost perfectly in line with what you were getting at there. Were there ever any products that you had come up with that you wanted to pursue or that you wanted to get out there for the public, but just never hit the shelves? You know, I know that the products were somewhat limited in comparison, especially to other, you know, other titles, other shows that were out there at the time. Was there ever anything that you personally put the brakes on?
No, actually, we had a whole multi-year, I mean, I put together a kind of a master plan for the company, which Fred and the others on the board were enthusiastic about, and it was kind of a 3 to 5 year development plan of various both publications and music products and play products that were wonderfully integrated with each other and with the program and it was a kind of a rollout plan. And my guess is, what's my guess, there was the possibility that that might have been quite successful. But the company got destroyed in 1973 by, of all things, well, a triple whammy. The coup de grace happening to be the Arab oil embargo, but it'll take me a minute to get to that if you've got the time.
Sure.
In 1970, I can't remember what it was, 3 or 4, it was probably 74, the first of the three whammies in this perfect storm, where I got a call one day from the guy who was the brand new general counsel at Sears. Sears was at that time by far the biggest, most successful retailer in America. I mean, Walmart and didn't exist. Kmart was just a small time player. JCPenney's was their biggest rival, but it was slipping fast, and Sears just dominated the world of retail marketing. And they sold children's records, among other things, and they were by far, like 90%, there's maybe 80%, the biggest distributor of Mr. Rogers records. They were also, as you may know, the principal underwriter of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood mm-hmm. through the Sears Roebuck Foundation.
Sure.
So I get a call one day from this guy who is the new general counsel at Sears. And he said, Elliot, he said, I think we've got a problem. Could you come on up here and let's talk? So I go up there and he says, here's the deal. He said, I've just been reviewing all the things that we're doing here. And I see that on the one hand, through our foundation, we give you a tax deductible for us, a donation of $1 million a year or whatever it was. And through our for-profit stores, we're selling millions of dollars a year worth of Mr. Rogers records. I think the IRS could legitimately make a case that we are using tax-deductible dollars to promote and merchandise for-profit products that we're selling in our stores.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see that we can do both. We can either continue to underwrite the program or continue to sell your records. And we've decided that we want to continue to underwrite the program, and we're going to stop selling your records. Okay, so there goes 80% of the revenue stream of Small World Enterprises.
Gosh.
Just stopped dead in its tracks. Okay, so I stagger home and call an emergency meeting of my staff here and say, guys, we just lost our primary distribution source. I find a guy who has recently retired as a record distribution business and put him to work stitching together a kind of mom-and-pop national network of other stores to sell Mr. Rogers records. But it never amounts to very much. Then, just as we're in the midst of that, about a month or two into that, I get a call from CBS that has been the place that has pressed our records and has been the physical manufacturer and physical distributor of them. And they say, we've decided to drop out of the children's record business.
Gosh.
Oh, okay. So I lost my primary retailer. I lost my manufacturer and distributor. What next? So I scramble around. I find a place, you know, that a custom house that presses records, and I find a new source for manufacturing the record jackets and all of this stuff. And then in the fall of that year, the Arabs decide to cut off oil supply to the United States. That is the first moment when I learn, with something that I probably might have, certainly, possibly should have learned long since, and that is that the black plastic from which a record is made, is polyvinyl chloride, is a petroleum derivative.
Mm.
No oil, no polyvinyl chloride, no black goo, and therefore no records. And my record manufacturer says I can't get the goo, and so I can't make you any records. And that was true, of course, from coast to coast. So that basically destroyed the company. And so we never really got to execute our master plan. And at that point, I just wound down the company. I said, you know, we cannot come back from this. And then nobody wanted to put any fresh capital into the company. Mm-hmm. And so what we did instead was, Fred and I made the decision that what we would do is to assign all of the revenue-producing licenses that I had developed, because I'd gotten book deals going with Hallmark and Golden Books, and you know, we had a lot of, you know, some pretty good contracts going. And so we assigned all those revenue producing contracts to Family Communications Inc. To be a kind of an ongoing dowry for that company, and then we closed up shop at Small World Enterprises, and I moved on to do other things.
So that right there essentially explains why Small World essentially just disappeared there in the middle of the 70s. You know, like when you look at the fine print on the back of the products and things like that.
Right.
It seems like there's tons and tons of Small World items, and then suddenly it's just gone. And that right there, you know, that explains the story behind the story there. At the same time, though, I guess I have to ask: does that kind of contribute to the reason that there's multiple pressings or multiple versions of the same record album that are available out there?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Just because of the shift.
Yeah, because some of them were CBS, and then
sure.
Some of them were Small World.
And that was
right?
that was all business, to where it was just a shift from, you know, when funding was lost at one place and you know, just the dominoes fell. Okay.
You got it. Yep,
that makes complete sense. Well, you know, for the sake of your time and the time of those listening, I do want to cover one more topic with you, and this is a total shift of topics. I'm curious what your thoughts are on Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. You know, this is the new adventure from the Fred Rogers Company, from what was formerly Family Communications. What are your thoughts on Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood?
I think. I've obviously seen it, and I think it's a good try, and I think they're doing absolutely the best they can under the inherent limitations of what they've decided to do, which is to, you know, create some new characters and to adopt an animated and sort of an approach and so forth. My enthusiasm for it is, on the one hand, if I had never seen Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, I would say this is a really absolutely terrific program. And back in the years when I was writing articles about children's programming and reviewing and critiquing children's programming, you know, back in the 70s, or 60s, I mean, before I joined Fred, I would have praised it to the sky. And so I need to set that context, okay? But, you know, there was an old saying, you know, in the First World War, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry? I'm sort of like the farm boy who got to see Paris, and it's hard to go back to the farm from there. And I wish that they had, and this is probably where I part company maybe with everybody at the Mr. Rogers Company, and also possibly with Joanne, who is a dear, dear, dear friend of mine. I wish they'd found Fred Rogers Jr. I cannot accept the premise that some put forth that Fred was so sui generis that there is nobody else who could establish the through the camera relationship that he did. Mm-hmm. And I just don't believe that. I don't believe that for a minute. I think if you gave me 6 months and a budget, I could turn up a half a dozen, people who had sufficient whatever, mm-hmm. je ne sais quoi, to do what Fred did. Mm-hmm. And to that end, and I hadn't thought about this, but one of the projects that I did work on at Small World that never went anywhere, I developed a successor program, to pick up kids who graduated from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And it was a program called Secrets. And I won't get off onto all of that, but, I myself was the host for the pilot program, and the pilot program was greeted with a lot of enthusiasm and stuff, and we never got around to producing it for reasons that aren't worth going into right now, but I think we could find another Fred Rogers, and I think that children today deserve another Fred Rogers, and so I guess that's my take on it.
Sure. Your mention of Secrets makes me give this is another example of how I feel like this could be about a 5 or 6 hour conversation, because I would love to know more about that at some point, but that's something I've never come across, is the idea of a successor program, and to think that there was one in the works, I'd definitely love to learn more about that at some point. So, but for the sake of time, we're pushing an hour here, and I don't think that's overboard by any means, considering the amount of information that you can share, the amount of experiences you had with the neighborhood. I do want to take a couple of minutes and talk about Elliot Daly. What's Elliot Daly doing these days?
I'm mostly writing, and I retired from various business pursuits a couple of different times, but I finally made it stick about 4 or 5 years ago. And mostly what I'm doing now is writing. I have a couple of unpublished book manuscripts, one of which is called Taking Your Lumps. The subtitle is Learning from Mistakes in Business, and my description of Small World Enterprises is one of the chapters in that book. But also watching some of my clients make avoidable mistakes and how you rebound from them and learn from them and stuff. And then I have another manuscript about the transition to retirement and the ways in which that affects a person and what the inner processes and developmental steps are in that. But right now I'm about to go back up to we have a old farmhouse up in Maine where we spend the summer, and I'm just about to go back up there in another week or so and hide away for about 6 weeks and work on a book for kids in the 9 to 12 age range. The title is, I'm not exactly sure what the title is, but the title could be You Don't Have to Be Fat. And it's about trying to help kids that age, which is a really critical age in terms of determining whether baby fat and early, mid-childhood obesity is going to be carried forward into teen and adulthood obesity. Mm-hmm. And so I've been working, I'm working on that, and I'm very, very committed to that, having grown up as a fat kid, but I'm not fat now, but I spent much of my adulthood as a fat person. In fact, one of my published books, HarperCollins and Hazelwood, a number of years back, called Sick and Tired of Being Fat, which I wrote under the pseudonym of Elliot Alexander. But at any rate, so I'm working on that book, and I really, really care a lot about that. But I also write op-eds. I write a column occasionally for the Huffington Post, which is an internet newspaper. Mm-hmm. And then I write for our local Trenton Times op-eds. So that's kind of what I'm doing, in addition to enjoying many other dimensions of life.
Well, so retirement isn't always retirement, right? Because you tend to be as busy after you retire as you were before.
Well, as a matter of fact, the title of that manuscript is formerly called, quote, retirement, unquote.
I know, in talking to my dad, my dad retired a few years back, and you know, he talks about just being busier now than he ever was before he retired. So I know.
And you hear everybody say that, and you think, oh yeah, tell me about it. You know, because you're running around, you know, working 14 hours a day and all this stuff. By God, it's true. It really is true. But it's also why I'm learning to run away to the farmhouse from time to time and
absolutely
just shut down.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Elliot, I can't thank you enough for just spending some time with us. You know, your wealth of knowledge and your wealth of experiences is invaluable, really, because it's the side of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that, you know, like I said earlier, the casual fan a lot of times doesn't realize it even existed. And it's good to get a take on the real life side of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood versus just what we saw for, you know, 28 minutes a day. As children.
Yeah.
So I truly appreciate your time, and I hope that we can possibly do this again and I can learn some more about your involvement, about secrets, about what else is going on with your retirement.
Anytime. And listen, Tim, again, congratulations and my personal thanks for what you're doing. It's a really, really, really valuable mission that you're on.
That's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thanks again.
You bet. Take care.